Welcome to the Flow Tracy Money Audio Commentary. This is Owen Tracy recording, and it is 3:26 p.m. and that is Central Time. Today is September 15th. So this is the spread here between the CPI and the Fed funds rate. It's at negative 600 basis points. So there's obviously the potential that next week the Fed is going to raise rates by at least 75 basis points. There's some speculation that they might go a full 100 basis points. I still think that's unlikely, but I think they will go with 75 basis points. So we're still in this environment where liquidity conditions are tightening. Now, negative 600 basis points, this is a very simplistic way of looking at this figure. There's another way. So this is the United States annualized real interest rate. Now, if you annualize it rather than looking, and I'm not a big fan of looking at annualized rates, but it is the convention for a lot of financial data that's released by the US government. And if you annualize it, then it's almost 0%. So we've had a significant tightening. Obviously, inflation is still running high, and the pace with which it's expanding might be moderating, but it's still a very high figure. And interest rates are starting to catch up, but they're a long way from catching up. So saying that we have positive real interest rates doesn't make a lot of sense, but if you annualize it out, you get to 0% or very close to it. Now let's think about gold. So one of the things that people, and I am certainly one of them, say is that gold does well in a negative real interest rate environment. But CPI has been running ahead of the Fed funds rate for a decade. And in that time, we've had both bull and bear markets for gold. Well, that alone tells us that a negative real interest rate environment is not a sufficient condition for a gold bull market. And at the present moment, the negative real interest rate environment is getting less negative, even though I think we can argue that it's nowhere near zero in real terms. We're still in an environment where it is getting less negative. And then on top of that, the dollar is exceptionally firm. So what we should really be looking at is a two tick box phenomena for bull markets in gold. We first need to have the negative real interest rate environment, but then gold does best when it's the strongest currency in the world. Now, it is appreciating versus lots of currencies, but not the US dollar. The Federal Reserve is raising rates faster than just about anywhere else and looks likely to continue to do so. There's also the big difference because the kind of inflation that the USA is dealing with is about demand. Now, obviously, there have been supply bottlenecks. And there have been issues with trying to get people back to work after telling them that they can earn more by staying at home. And that is obviously something that's a challenge for any administration. But the reality is that they pumped massive amounts of money into the system. A lot of people didn't spend that money and they saved it. And that means that savings increased. So people have plenty of resources. They're not in a hurry to take up jobs. And retail activity is still strong. So this is a demand story more than a supply story in the USA. Whereas in Europe, it really is more about supply. And you've got a war on the border of the EU for the first time in 20 years. And now it's looking increasingly likely that there are going to be significant issues with supply of energy during the winter. So Europe's problem is a supply problem. Well, interest rate rises don't really work when you're thinking about that. So if we look at the dollar euro chart, so we can see the dollar in an uptrend here. Well, we have a sequence of ranges, one above the last. Following the breakout from this little base formation in September of last year, we've had one range above the last. Now, we've had a little inconsistency in the region of parity, which is not all that surprising. So it did dip into the most recent range. but it's well off the lows in here this week. So it's going to have to at least break the sequence of higher reaction lows and push down into this underlying trading range to really confirm that we're back in a demand-dominated environment for the euro. And obviously, this continued strength in the dollar is weighing on the gold price. One of the big questions has been, why hasn't silver been following gold lower? And it rallied really quite impressively over the last 2 weeks, but it is now starting to moderate, and it has not yet broken the sequence of lower rally highs. And when we look at the ratio, then we can see that the sequence of lower rally highs is still intact. So silver might have outperformed in the short term, but now we're at the first area of potential resistance. And if gold continues to extend its decline, then that's likely to put pressure on silver as well. Now, that obviously has a knock-on effect for gold shares. So gold shares were also in negative territory in here today. Now we've had a really quite profound decline over the course of the last few months, and it's coming back down into the region of the lows from back in 2020, which was a really attractive buying opportunity. Now let's just think about this. Why is it that Or how much further will the dollar go? How much higher will interest rates go in the USA? And how likely is it that the dollar will remain the dominant, or the by far the strongest currency in the world? Well, obviously these are very large questions. So let's just pay attention to what kind of signal the stock market is giving to us. The Nasdaq has encountered resistance in the region of the 200-day moving average on two significant occasions in the last 6 months, and there's a sequence of ranges one below the last. And now we're coming back down into the region of the 1,000-day moving average. So this is a really insignificant do-or-die moment here. If we go back and look at the 1,000-day moving average, since 2009, every time we've had a medium-term correction, it's found support above the 1,000-day moving average and tested it in 2020, and tested it again in June of this year. Every one of those tests has been a buying opportunity, and in a bull market, buying the dip always works, because it's almost like a self-fulfilling prophecy. If we have a demand-dominated environment where people are buying and holding and using occasional dips to increase their positions, well, on aggregate, what that succeeds in doing is withholding supply from the market. So as the trend persists, more and more supply is being withheld from the market, and the pace of the advance picks up. And every dip is bought, and bought aggressively, so that you get these beautiful bounces. And those bounces then tend to be self-fulfilling, because people feel good about themselves and feel like it's the right decision. And we had a lot of that between June and September. So there was a lot of buying the dip. There was Warren Buffett stepping in and buying Occidental Petroleum. And that was viewed as a really significant event, that you have one of the biggest investors in the world finally stepping in off the sidelines and putting capital to work. So this must be the low. And we had a significant rebound. But it only got back above the 200-day moving average for a week and then came back down again. Now, if the index falls below the 1,000-day moving average and then that move is sustained, well, then that's going to hold out the prospect that the secular trend is over and that we're going to move into a more volatile, rangy period. And that could easily translate into a secular bear market where we get a generational long process of PE contraction and rising dividend yields. And that was the refrain from the big picture Friday audio for about a decade. And between about 2001 and 2010, and really 11, when markets finally started breaking out to new all-time highs, that was what David and I talked about, was a generational process of P/E ratio contraction and rising dividend yields. And it framed why we picked the big companies for the autonomies. We were looking for the kinds of companies that would do well regardless of what came, and those that would be levered to the rise of the global middle class, the march of globalization, and then the companies that would prosper in a debt-driven market, well, while also benefiting from the march of technological innovation. And above all, a secular bear market in oil because of the USA's energy independence. Well, a lot of the factors that contributed to that move, where it was the NASDAQ and those technology shares really were the best performers, well, they prospered in an environment where interest rates were really low, where there was massive availability of credit, where they benefited from the rollout of 4G and the cloud, and they were able to build massive franchises, and that really spanned the globe. But when we look at the performance of the mega caps, well, then they're starting to underperform, and certainly haven't been outperforming the market for 2 years. And this ratio is coming back down towards the lower side of its range. Now, then let's think about Adobe. So, this is a company that pioneered the subscription business model. And since the peak in December of last year, the share has halved, and it was down in a seriously dynamic manner in here today. So it's not sufficient to have a subscription business model. You must also have a product that has a sufficiently wide moat that it can't simply be replicated. And this is a challenge for Adobe because it's quite easy to create PDFs these days, and there's a lot of video editing software, and there's a lot of photo editing software out there. You don't necessarily have to pay the big bucks for Photoshop. So obviously this is problematic. Autodesk tried to do with video and computer graphics what Adobe did with video, or excuse me, with photo editing, and that share has also pulled back in a violent manner. It's not quite down 50%, but certainly there is a challenging environment in front of it. So one thing that everyone is asking is how high are interest rates going to go? And I don't really believe that's the most important question. I think interest rates are going to go up until something breaks. The big question is what's going to break, and how much contagion will there be? I think this is a much more pressing question. And let's just think about what are the most over-leveraged sectors. So certainly we have companies like private equity companies that have borrowed a lot of money and invested a lot of money. And the outlook for those companies that they own is going to be heavily influenced by the outlook for liquidity and levered loans are obviously a sector that is going to attract additional interest the higher interest rates and bond yields go. So the total return index on levered loans, it's still in the region of the 200-day moving average, and there's a sequence of lower rally highs. There's the clear potential that this index is going to continue to roll over. And the closer we get to a recession, the more likely it is that we're going to have or we're going to have more to talk about. than with the leveraged loan sector, because it's exceptionally difficult to identify exactly where those loans are. So that's one source of potential volatility. And then we have China. So the Chinese property sector is massively inflated, and the state-owned property index is pushing higher. But it's pushing higher at the expense of the renminbi. The reality is that for China, it's impossible to have both a strong currency and also spend as much money as is required to support the stock, to support the property market. I find it especially interesting that it's on the days when the renminbi is particularly weak that the property index goes up. So we are seeing evidence of China turning the corner. They are starting to print money, but that comes at the necessary expense of devaluing the currency. So that's also potentially then likely to create an inflationary problem in China. And it's the only major economy that hasn't had a big inflation problem because they didn't engage in the same degree of money printing during the pandemic. But now they're probably going to have to. But it's certainly, I don't think, going to be very productive to reach clear conclusions about China until after the Party Congress. There's obviously going to be a lot of lockdowns until that happens, and until well after the new suite of policies are released. Now, what I would like to do is look at what did the S&P 500 look like before the 1987 crash? Because we're looking at markets in, I think, a variety of ways. So one thing that characterized the S&P 500 in 1987 was that it was still trending higher. There was a new central banker, and the market was looking to test that new central banker, Alan Greenspan. And the market pulled back in an exceptionally violent manner in October of 1987. And in the space of just a couple of days, we saw this huge crash. Now, so we were in an environment where interest rates were tightening. There was an awful lot of leverage in the market, and new financial innovations had just been developed, which were index futures. Everyone tried to hedge at the same time. Well, it's not like history repeats itself. For one thing, the market has been coming down all year, so we're not so close to the peaks any longer. But one thing that I think is especially interesting is that we've seen these stories about option positioning and where trillions of options are expiring at on a given day, and it's creating a derivative response in the underlying equities. And the options market has become so large that it's now feeding back into the underlying. So it's not beyond the bounds of possibility that we could have the same kind of environment in the event that there is a credit event, whether that's going to be in the commodity markets, the banking sector, the emerging markets, and because of the strength of the dollar and the volume of dollar-denominated debt out there in the emerging markets. We can't be at I think too surprised if something breaks, creates a contagion that influences option positioning, which has a knock-on effect on the stock market, and then subsequently prices pull back in a very violent manner. That is the kind of thing that could be a catalyst for central banks to change their minds, and it would be the acceleration of the trend that's been underway over the course of the last 6 or 7 months. And that's, I think, particularly relevant today. We are at a critical juncture for the Nasdaq. We're right back in the region of that 1,000-day moving average. And this is the point where if support is going to be found, it will happen within the next 500 points. The other big over-levered market is Bitcoin. So Bitcoin's had significant declines in the past. It's pulled back by 83%, 71%, 55%, 74%. So the depth of these declines isn't unusual. And historically, the size of these declines have been buying opportunities. Now the price is back below 20,000 again. The two big consistency characteristics, the things that people put their most faith in, are first that Bitcoin has never pulled back into an underlying range. But it did do that. The low here was around 17,600, and the peak back here is over 19,000. So that's a trend in consistency. It's never done that before, but it didn't hold it. And I don't think anyone's going to be really falling out of bed because the price dipped back into the other high. But if prices break down from here and start trending lower, well, then we're back inside the underlying range, and it's never done that before. That's a major trend in consistency. Then there's the other secular trend consistency for Bitcoin. And that is that anyone who's ever bought Bitcoin, all they've had to do is hold it for 4 years and they've made money. So if prices come back down below the $7,000 or $8,000 level, well, then that trend consistency will also have been broken. And there's a phenomenally large proportion of the US market in particular that owns cryptocurrencies. And those savings and that wealth effect are potentially going to go to money heaven. So we should then think about Ethereum. And the merge went ahead in here today. And that's a big event. And it's the culmination of some really extensive development activity that's been going on in crypto to create a business model for Ethereum that allows it to submit to the dividend discount model. And that's a really incredible piece of programming activity. But it has nothing to do with the price. And the price is more about liquidity. So even though we had this significant event go ahead, and it appears so far at least to be successful, the price was down $100. We had a little rally for the last 3 weeks into that event, and now we're seeing some selling the news. Cryptocurrencies are liquidity barometers. And the weakness that we're seeing right now isn't encouraging. Then let's think about oil prices. So crude oil is trending down, and we've had a sequence of lower rally highs and a preponderance of downward dynamics from those highs. And the price was down another $3 in here today. So it has so far failed to push back above that $100 area. We're seeing some quite clear divergence between European natural gas prices, which were up and down in here today, and US natural gas prices, which were clearly down. So that's going to remove some of the inflationary pressures. Natural gas was down 85 cents in here. But what we're starting to see now is that certainly there's problems with supply. But more importantly, it's about demand. And demand is much more volatile than the majority of investors are willing to give credence to, and that there is clear potential that prices are going to come back down again as a recession unfolds. And I think this really does come to the crux of the argument, that we're inevitably going to have a recession. And prices are going to suffer. Unemployment is going to rise, and there will be a hit to demand. And deflationary forces will prevail. And central banks will then have to make additional liquidity available. And what they've done historically is leave that assistance in the market much longer than it's necessarily required. And that has helped to stoke investment bubbles. So what they would need to do in order to get in control of inflation is to support the economy during a recession, but remove that assistance early. And that could even create a double dip recession. But it would help to get inflation under control. And we have a serious moral hazard problem in the USA. People were told that they could stay at home and do nothing and still make more than they would from working. And now they're being told, or then they were told that they couldn't be evicted, so they didn't have to pay their rent. They didn't have to pay their mortgages because there were mortgage holidays. And now there are student loan jubilees, and you don't have to pay your student loan either. So this is creating huge moral hazard. There is absolutely no reason to stop buying, and retail sales remain quite firm because people feel that they don't have to save for a rainy day because the government will always ride to the rescue and make things better. Well, eventually the government will run out of money, and the surge that we're seeing in government bond yields, particularly in Europe, but certainly also in the USA, reflect the real phenomenon that those bills will have to be paid eventually. So we're at a very difficult situation for central bankers. They have to do what their job entails. And how they can achieve that without causing a deep recession, well, the only way then would be to have lots of small recessions. And I think that is probably the most likely scenario. I think with that, I'll leave you for today, and I'll wish all the best to all of you.